This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you remember clapping along to Miss Mary Mack when you were younger, or folding up a piece of paper to make one of those origami fortune teller things? We'll talk to a writer about the shared games, legend, and rhymes that become traditions of childhood. Now more than 700,000 families in Wisconsin could be affected by the end of additional benefits from the Food Share program this February. Food Share benefits are Wisconsin's version of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, at the federal level. That's commonly referred to as food stamps. During the COVID-19 pandemic's early days, Food Share beneficiaries received additional benefits aimed at helping with the impact of COVID during what was considered a public health emergency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's still needed, these additional Food Share benefits, or do you think it's okay that they wane now? Starting next February, if you use or have used Food Share, what do you think about the end of additional benefits? Do you work with people dealing with hunger in your community? What are you seeing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sherry Tussler is Executive Director of Hunger Task Force based in Milwaukee. Sherry, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Before we get to the expiration of these benefits, can you talk about what they did? What kind of additional things were people seeing when this started?
Well, when the pandemic began, people had some flexibility both around applying for Food Share and then proving their eligibility for Food Share over this nearly 3-year term. And so the program was a lot more flexible. It was easier to sign up, to get, and to maintain your Food Share benefits.
And what can you talk about some of the dollar amounts that, say, a family might have seen along the way?
Well, families could have seen between $835, as much as $759, depending upon the size of that family. Individuals may have sprung up from $23 a month to as high as $281 per month. And so what we're seeing altogether with those 709,000 people is a loss of about $1 billion, that's $1 billion with a B, dollars in Food Share benefits to the state of Wisconsin.
The benefits were started during the public health emergency that came out with COVID-19. Technically, that's never been retracted. What do you make of the timing and this scheduled end of these enhanced benefits coming up next month?
Well, they came as a big surprise because we've always been told that when the public health emergency ended, the dual public health emergency, state and federal, is when the quote-unquote unwinding would occur, because it's also going to affect Medicaid into the future. And instead, when we passed our Omnibus Spending Bill Act on December 29th, it was tucked in there that any states remaining that were still getting the emergency allotments would have those allotments discontinued, with the final payment being in February.
Talking to Sherry Tussler from Hunger Task Force, looking at the end of enhanced Food Share benefits affecting more than 700,000 people in Wisconsin. I think I said families earlier, 700,000 people here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or thoughts on this. If it affects your life or those near and dear to you or people you work with, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Colette is with us in Eagle River. Colette, hi. What did you want to share with us?
Hi. My son is affected by this. He is high-functioning autistic. He lives in subsidized housing, which is not really all that subsidized. And right now, there's not much left after housing. And this extra benefit allows him to get good, healthy food without having to scrape by. I mean, we are okay, so we probably would never let him go hungry. But, he's several hundred miles away from us, so it makes him feel much more independent. He does work, two 3-hour shifts at Culver's, which really doesn't add very much to his income.
Colette, can I ask if you've been receiving these benefits for a while, did you see a change in what it was like to apply for and keep these benefits going? Did the red tape get cut a little bit?
No, the red tape wasn't really, well, we were already on food stamps and it was some ridiculous amount, like $10 a month, which really isn't that, a gallon of milk and 3 cans of soup. And then it's brought to, I'd have to look at more like $200, and that allows him, you know, much more independence, because he gets a debit card, he buys what he needs, he gets to experiment with food a little bit without, you know, just having cereal and milk and white bread and cheap stuff from Quick Trip.
Colette, thanks so much for sharing your son's story with us. Sherry, a person with disabilities in this case, one of the people who might be affected by these changes.
Yes, the elderly, blind, and disabled will be affected pretty dramatically. They're going to lose about $258 per month in benefits. It'll be a substantial cut to them. Before the pandemic, a lot of seniors were living the same way that her son was, in subsidized housing and not receiving very many benefits at all. So it is a challenge. I also want to comment that working families, more than 46% of the food share individuals are members of working families. And so people just like her son are indeed working, but they still need that food share program to help make ends meet.
Thanks a lot for sharing that. And good luck to you and your son. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Sherry, somebody who's receiving food share benefits now, concerned about the end of these enhanced benefits, are there things they can do to make sure that they're receiving, starting in February, at least for sure, as much as they're eligible for?
Yes, particularly for the elderly, blind, and disabled, but for the entire population. If you've got medical expenses, they are deductible from your income. And so if you have not thought about collecting up all of your unpaid or paid medical bills for the last 6 months to a year and phoning the state and letting them know to update your case with those expenses, then your income will be impacted by that. And as a result, you should get a higher level of benefits. We're also strongly encouraging any family members with children to make sure that they've completed a free and reduced price meals application for their school if they are not receiving universal meals, because the children can get breakfast and lunch at school every day. And then finally, for families who have very young children, any children younger than five, they're eligible for the Women, Infants, and Children's Program. And that program provides a debit card, just like Food Share, to go out and buy healthy foods at the grocery store. So please enroll in the Women, Infants, and Children's Program if you have young children, if you're pregnant or postpartum.
What does it take to apply for Food Share in the first place?
Basically, you have to prove anything you say yes to. That's the easiest part of it. So I remind people that it's a modern system now, so you can go online, you can do it with your smartphone, or you can do it over the telephone. So you don't have to make a long ride to the county seat in order to find your application site. You can just go to access.wisconsin.gov and sign up there. And if you're right on the edge and thinking, well, maybe I'm not eligible, go ahead and apply and see if you are, because you can check that system out in the privacy of your own home.
Some of the people who might be eligible for their benefits, they might not have either direct access to the internet or the ability to use it. Are there agencies around the state that can help hook people up with the access to the initial application?
There absolutely are. You can first call the state of Wisconsin, and they can take your application over the telephone, or you can go to your community action agency across the state, and there's one serving every county, and ask for assistance there. Here in Milwaukee County, Hunger Task Force operates two self-service locations that you can visit as well.
We're talking to Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Hunger Task Force based in Milwaukee, about changes to food share benefits that will end additional benefits, some enhanced benefits to the program this February. These started in the early days of COVID. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about an end to these additional food share benefits? If this affects you or a family member directly, what are you looking at? What have the benefits meant for you? If you work, say, at a food pantry, are you expecting to see more people coming in for food? We're going to get a look at what hunger looks like in Wisconsin, what this could mean for food pantries. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Hunger Task Force, about the upcoming end to additional food share benefits. A recent announcement based on the budget passed by Congress means those enhanced benefits will end next month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. To what extent did the start of COVID impact your own food security? Would an end to additional food share benefits impact you or your family, a loved one? If you work with food and hunger relief, what are you watching for with these upcoming changes? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sherry, I want to turn to your work now, providing emergency food relief in Milwaukee. What has demand looked like over the course of the COVID era in particular?
Demand actually dropped dramatically right after these emergency food share allotments came into place. We also saw a number of pantry closures related to people volunteering and not able to or feeling comfortable going out of their own home during the Safer at Home order. And so what we're seeing now is a return of increased demand for emergency food at food pantries. One of the concerns we obviously have with the end of these emergency allotments is that the pantries have been running full service the entire time and with enhanced funding from the federal government as well. And that funding has also ended. And so the $1 billion that is coming in food share to Wisconsin's economy can't possibly be replaced by local food pantries. And so if folk are thinking, oh, I'll just go to the food pantry, that could be a problem by early summer when some rationing of food at food pantries is likely to occur.
We had a caller on the line who couldn't stay on, who described themselves as someone who works on food share issues and with hunger relief, and used the word terrified by the changes coming along when both of those things, as you mentioned, end, the direct food share funding and the funding for pantries. Is that overstating it or is that about right?
Well, I'm deeply concerned. We'll be here at Hunger Task Force doing the work that we do on providing leadership in the community as well as the state and doing what we can to leverage hunger as well as identify to elected officials what the need in our local communities really is going to be. It would have obviously been better if they had stepped this program down rather than just ending it dramatically. But we're going to have to live with the consequences of what will occur. We're going to do our best to make sure people in need of emergency food are getting the help that they need and the direction that they'll need to be able to make ends meet into the future.
How are you working to do that? Again, the funding side is getting cut some. The food share side is getting cut. What are you trying to do to help bridge that gap?
Well, we got to remind people that they're about to deal with a struggle and that they need to set into place some coping mechanisms. They need to think about being intentional around what they purchase, when they purchase it. They need to not waste food. They need to make sure that their children are eating those school meals and that they're participating in WIC if they can at all. Seniors are eligible for a program called Stockbox. And so we're going to ask people to turn to the other federal nutrition assistance programs and enroll in them because not all of those programs are fully enrolled in our state. And then we're going to remind them that they're going to eat the foods that they've eaten in the past when they were struggling. Everybody knows what that meal is. It may be cheaper cuts of meat. It may be no meat at all. It may be smaller portion sizes. It may be that you're going to skip that meal so that your child can eat. But those are the enduring struggles that low-income people across the state have faced, will face, and they're just going to become more commonplace into the near future.
Now, food share is funded by a federal program, but as I understand it, Sherry, states have some control over, you know, what it looks like, how it works, eligibility and things like that. Are there things unique to Wisconsin?
There really aren't. Wisconsin has deployed all of the flexibilities that have been offered it. They've offered a program called Pandemic EBT, which replaced school meals during the height of the pandemic, and that program will continue, but at a lesser level. The state does have a budget surplus, and so it's possible that state aid or a state-based food program could at least aid people that are in trouble. And we have been working with electeds about that as a possibility.
Now, you, as I mentioned, are based in Milwaukee. I assume you're in contact with your peers around the state. Is this something that we're seeing from, you know, the biggest city down to the smallest communities?
Absolutely. Hunger Task Force supplies something called the Badger Box, which is an ARPA expensed food box of all Wisconsin foods. And it goes to 17 different communities across the state, including some tribal communities and some rural and remote spaces. And my experience has been that if you get north of Highway 8, that food costs literally double, and that a lot of people really do need that extra box of food just in order to make their utility or medical payments. And so the cost of food is going to increase the more rural or remote that you get. The caller talked about food purchases at a Quick Trip. For a lot of people, the Quick Trip is their store. And so things are going to get tough.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tina is with us in Lake Geneva. Tina, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What did you want to bring up to you?
Sure. I am a social worker. I do work with populations that do receive food share. And I think I understand some of the reasoning that people think for ending these additional allotments. However, as I stated to you, if you go into the grocery store and look at the price of groceries, I almost wonder if it shouldn't be going the other way. As a former single mother years ago, I don't know how families are doing it. It used to be I could get by through the week with a loaf of bread and a dozen eggs and feed my family, and now that's no longer the case.
Tina, thanks for the call. Sherry, Tina brings up inflation, which I hadn't brought up yet. How are you seeing that affect people's ability to try to make their food share and other food dollars stretch out?
Well, we've been thinking about it as the perfect storm. So at the same time that we're pulling these benefits away from people, they're paying really historically high prices for the basics. Eggs have gone up 50%, milk nearly 16%. And this is over this time last year. So people are really, it's taken a toll on people when they get to the checkout and they can't afford all the foods that they once were able to afford. And then by March, they'll have to figure out how to do that with substantially less money.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Hunger Task Force, looking at the end of enhanced food share benefits. Just announced they're expected to end next month unless something changes. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello. I get Meals on Wheels here in Milwaukee, which are delivered and provided through the Goodwill Company. And I'm wondering if this ruling is going to affect that also.
Oh, interesting, Sherry. Do you know about that?
Yes, I do. And Nancy, you should not be worried about that. That will continue. All Meals on Wheels programs are funded through the Department of Aging and the Aging and Disability Resource Funding. And so this will not impact you.
Nancy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sherry, are there other concerns that you are looking at that you think the public may not realize about these changes coming to food share?
Yeah, I think there's a big one that we're not thinking about, and that is our agricultural economy. If we pull $1 billion out of Wisconsin's food purchasing economy, we're harming farmers, we're harming cheesemakers, food producers, we're harming that person at the grocery store who 2 years ago we thanked for being a hero. We're harming trucking and transportation industries when food doesn't get bought or transported to local communities. And so there's that group of people that also are putting food on the table, and those are people working in the food system and people who are growing our food, and they're also going to be hurt, and they're going to have a hard time making ends meet as well.
Time for one more caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I think that the state legislature with the budget surplus really needs to address this issue, and specifically on our tax form, instead of electing to donate a dollar to some presidential election fund, maybe we could have a box in there to have a dollar go to our state food shelves.
Oh, interesting, Jeff. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Sherry, that voluntary checkoff as tax season comes up?
You know, almost all hunger relief organizations, whether they're food pantries, soup kitchens, homeless shelters, or food banks, are operated through the generosity of individuals. And so we would appreciate that kindness. We would also remind people that it's still $1 billion, so it may take more than each of us doing a dollar. But everybody should do what they can to help out their neighbor. That's the difference making that happens here in Wisconsin.
Jeff, thanks for that call. And Sherry, in our last minute and a half or so, if people out there are thinking, yeah, I'd like to help, what can I do? Where would you steer them?
I would steer them to their local food pantry. I would encourage them to volunteer and help out and give what food or time they can give. But I also would encourage them to pay very close attention as this process unfolds and to reach out to their elected official and express whatever concerns they have about the quality of life in their community and whether or not people have access to food or if they become completely dependent on charity, because working people should not have to depend on charity to keep a roof over their head.
And people, I've asked myself this before, are we better off donating food or cash to buy food to our local food shelter?
I always tell people to do what they feel is right.
Sherry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much.
That's Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Hunger Task Force. That's based in Milwaukee. She joined us today for a look at the end of additional food share benefits after changes in the federal budget. They are set to expire next month. The additional benefits were originally granted in the early days of COVID-19. This is something that affects you. Let us know about it. If you have additional questions about food and hunger in Wisconsin you'd like to see us tackle in a future conversation, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all day, every day online. You could stream live at WPR.org or search up and share archives of programs that you missed or that you want to share with friends. Find those all at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and do all the same stuff. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, transportation can be a huge issue for seniors in Wisconsin communities, large and small. And access to transportation, especially as people stop driving or phase out of driving, that can determine whether or not people are able to stay in their homes, their hometowns, as they age. Find out how some communities are working to meet those needs, what they're trying, what's worked, and what hasn't, and you can share your own story. Email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now we'll let The Simpsons set this conversation up. Does this song sound familiar?
Jingle bells, Batman smells, Robin laid an egg. Batmobile lost its wheel, the Joker got away. Hey!
That's singer Robert Goulet on The Simpsons with a holiday parody song that's well known to Bart and the kids and to real-life kids from multiple generations. It's just one example of something called child lore. The games like Miss Mary Mac or songs like Ring Around the Rosie or those folding fortune tellers that end up as a kind of shared kid culture. Our next guest looked into how child lore gets started and how it changes depending on when and where you learned it. And we want to hear from you. Do you have stuff like this you remember from your own childhood? Clapping games, urban legends, parody songs, you name it. What memories do you have of sharing that stuff with other kids? If you have young people in your life now, do you recognize some of their child culture from your days growing up? Or do you see some new kinds? You can let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic who oversees the family section. She's also the creator of the Friendship Files. She wrote about how these childhood traditions get passed down in the piece, Why Did We All Have the Same Childhood? I talked to her last month. Here's that conversation. Well, reading your piece, I was like, oh yeah, I remember all this stuff. And I probably hadn't thought about it in literally decades. What got you interested in taking a closer look at this child lore?
Yeah, well, before I knew that it was called child lore, in my mind, I was just sort of thinking of it as like the memes of the schoolyard, because I was thinking about like how these things spread, and we all seem to know them. You know, there's always like BuzzFeed listicles or whatever of like things only 90s kids remember. And it's like the cool S or like the cootie catchers or all these things. And I had always sort of idly wondered, how is it that we do all know these things? Because it's not like kids have like a robust, you know, network across the nation. And then when I looked into it, it turned out that really this is a subgenre of folklore, and it's folklore that is specific to kids and kid culture.
And child lore, reading your piece and looking into it more, it covers a lot of ground. You mentioned a couple, those origami cootie catchers, so-called, the fortune-telling things that I didn't have the folding talent to make when I was a kid. little tricks with calculators, little art things, songs. This is a lot of ground we're covering here.
Yeah, it's a really broad category. Really anything that is a piece of culture that kids have adopted and made their own could be child lore. So that can be all of the examples you mentioned. That can be jump rope rhymes, nursery rhymes, clapping games, even like something as small as like typing out naughty words on a calculator, right? Like that can be child lore too. It really does span a wide array of things, and it can kind of ebb and flow. But what was the most interesting to me was how many of these things persist through the generations. One of the folklorists I spoke to was much older than me and is British, and we shared a ton of the same references. So I thought that was pretty cool, just the longevity of it.
Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, looking at child lore, the little games and customs and songs and tricks and things like that that are common to kids, as Julie was just saying, from different generations, often from different places. You can join in. Do you have a memory of these things yourself, or are you seeing it right now in your own kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, Julie, a big question you tackled here is, a lot of these things were around a long time, of course, before we had the internet, yet they spread like memes. What do we know about how the same customs might be, as you just mentioned, in the United States and England and in a generation or two apart? How do these things spread?
Yeah, so the answer is kind of simple, and maybe you will find that disappointing, but it's actually pretty cool. It really is something that catches on to the degree that children want to teach it to each other. And so within a school, you know, older generations will be teaching the younger generations. Within the home, like siblings are really important, especially, you know, if you have an older sibling, you probably think they're really cool and want to emulate whatever they're doing. And then something that was mentioned to me as well was really the power of like cousins, which seems really random, but like those are often the closest peers that kids have who don't go to their school, but they do see them regularly. So there's like cross-pollination happening with cousins, or if new kids move to new schools and they bring their lore from their old school. So all of those things seem really simple. And yet, like, if something is catchy enough and like cool enough to kids, like that will be enough to really spread it like across the country.
You also write, I think about, the game of tag, which just appears like, we're running around tagging each other. I remember who taught me tag, and there are different permutations involving often diseases around tag. Could you talk about what you learned about that really basic playground game?
Yeah, I mean, the origin of tag, I could not tell you. Like, it is timeless. It came from everywhere and nowhere. But kids take that structure and they iterate it depending on what they're interested in or what they're thinking about. And like, obviously, you've probably played a lot of variations yourself, like freeze tag or the floor is lava or whatever. But it's also a structure that they can use to kind of work through what is going on around them. And so a colleague of mine, Kate Cray, actually wrote a piece in like March or April 2020 about how kids were starting to play coronavirus tag. And parents were worried, like, does this mean, you know, their kids are really traumatized and upset? Should we be worried about this? And, you know, experts told her at the time, like, no, this is so healthy. Like, this is play is how children work through things. And when I was reporting this story, and I mentioned that to a folklorist, they said, you know, I would not be surprised if in Victorian times they were playing cholera tag or something like that. Like, it's just a structure that is there and that kids build on with their interests or whatever they're working through. And I think that's part of what makes it, you know, so long lived.
And speaking of grownups being worried about kids, I think there's a sense like, oh, there's the internet and screens and social media, and now kids are doing childhood wrong. Is this killing those old traditional childhood games, the interconnected world we have?
Oh my goodness, no. And in fact, like every single folklorist that I spoke to or whose like book I read, every single one like had the same thing that they wanted to emphasize, which is that adults like throughout history have always said kids don't know how to play anymore. And they're blaming, you know, whatever the technology of the day is, probably like today it would be internet and TikTok. And like when it was TV, like TV was, you know, the problem. But they seem to think that part of the reason for that is because like child lore is sort of like a language and a culture that is of kids, by kids, for kids, and it is not for us. And so we don't always recognize it when we see it. We might just think like kids are running around on the playground screaming and going wild, but like to them, it is a game that like has a purpose and an organized principle. And like, we just don't always see that.
Another thing that's fun is, regional variation. Things are different. I think when you're talking to the English expert, you mentioned Jingle Bells, Batman Smells. What does Robin do?
Oh, yeah. Well, so you played the clip from The Simpsons, which is the one that I know, which is Robin laid an egg. And he said that he grew up singing Robin Flew Away. I like laid an egg better, but to each their own. But yeah, that is another element of it, right? Is like there is consistency, like remarkable consistency, and there is also variation depending on the time you grew up, where exactly you grew up, what was cool at your school, that sort of thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I believe Ring Around the Rosie is talking about the plague.
I have heard that. Is this one you grew up playing yourself, Susie, doing Ring Around the Rosie?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a little kid, I did that.
Yeah. And ashes, ashes, we all fall down. I believe is when they burned down towns. They would seal a town, not let anybody out, and just burn the whole thing down to try to stop the plague from growing.
Susie, thanks for the call. I've heard that, Julie. I've also heard that is wrong, and I'm not sure we're settled on the origins of Ring Around the Rosie. The tricky thing is, like you were saying with tag, it may be that we never know where these things end up coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, professional folklorists like can actually trace some of these things, probably not all of them, much better than, you know, me, a random person can. I don't want to, you know, commit on air to something I'm not sure about, but I'm pretty sure that in the book of the folklorist, the British folklorist Steve Rowd that I read, he had debunked one of those things. I can't remember if it was Ring Around the Rosie or some other kids game that's like associated with the plague. But it seemed like more questionable that that actually was the origin. Like that sort of maybe folklore in itself that like now we think that it was, you know, the plague at the time. So it's like folklore on top of folklore.
I love it. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. We're talking to Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees their family section, with us today to talk about her latest piece looking at traditions of childhood, otherwise known as child lore. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember some of these? Are you just thinking back about them now? Maybe something you haven't thought of in a good long while, depending on how old you were. What is one of these things you might remember from your school? A version of tag. Did you use those folding things to answer fortune teller type questions? Does he or she like me? That kind of important question to a fourth or fifth grader. Other songs or parodies or games. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about child lore, those clapping games, silly song parodies, and so much more that have become childhood traditions. Julie Beck stays with us from The Atlantic. She wrote a recent piece about this. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a memory of one of these, a question. If you remember who taught something like this to you, well, that's a tall order maybe, but if you do, I'd love to hear it. 800-642-1234. A jumping jack, a rhyme that you did, or jump rope thing that you did, a rhyme that you did. Let us know. 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Bryn is with us in North Freedom. Bryn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Bryn?
MASH, the person on air may instantly know what that is, but mansion, apartment, shack, house, a game on a piece of paper with pencil marks and figuring out what your future holds.
Oh, wow. Okay, that is just starting to come back to me. I don't remember if we called it MASH, but yeah, it was like kind of a weird fortune-telling thing. Do you remember any of your fortunes, Bryn, from back in the day? Oh, I think we lost Bryn. Julie, is that one you ran across?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I never forgot about MASH. It's hard to describe to people who don't know, because this is not a visual medium, but you would write, it would be sort of like a fortune telling game for your future, right? And so as the caller mentioned, you'd write MASH on the top, and that was like, are you going to live in a mansion, apartment, shack, or house? Yeah, you'd put all your crushes on there, whether that was like celebrity crushes or people from school. And then you would do, sort of like a random number generating thing. And then you'd count it out. And that's like who you were going to marry, where you were going to live, how many kids you would have, like all of that.
Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Bryn. You know what? I don't remember if I did that. I know my kids did it. That's why it seems so familiar. Bryn, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Julie, are we seeing new things like this getting created now, not just passed on, but new, whole new things or new versions of them?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about child lore is that it is sort of a paradox in that it is like very stable, but also always in flux, right? Like, so there are all kinds of things that are child lore that don't get passed on, for hundreds and hundreds of years, because they're kind of specific to the time that they come up in, right? So, for example, when I was a kid in elementary school, like my friends and I used to pretend to be the witches from Hocus Pocus on the playground, and we would play that all the time. And, after that movie was not super popular anymore, I doubt anybody was like thinking to play that, although they did just put out a sequel, so maybe it's coming back. There's all kinds of things that are tied to pop culture. Kids love to play, games related to that. And then there's probably also just like trends that come up in a school and they don't necessarily become super widespread. So all of that is child lore. The distinction is, the pop culture itself. So like Paw Patrol is not child lore. Like that was made by adults for children, but the games that kids play when they're pretending to be Paw Patrol characters, that is child lore, because what makes it child lore is kids making it their own.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Ginny on the road by Dodgeville. Ginny, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about Ginny?
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm in southwest Wisconsin, so we kind of had to make our own entertainment. And I remember three games. One was called Red Rover, Red Rover. And then you'd say, send, Robbie right over. And that kid would like run across and try to break like through a line of kids holding hands. And then the other one was a Annie Annie Over, where you threw a ball over the roof. We had a smokehouse, so the person on the other side would catch it, and then they had to try to figure out which side the person who threw the ball was coming, and if you hit them with the ball before they got all the way around, then you won, And then the last one was Cat's Cradle, where you used a string, and you kind of move the string around, and then you pass it from back and forth. It was really fun.
Ginny, it was a playground. Thank you so much for sharing those. I was in southeastern Michigan growing up. I was Robbie, and I played Red Rover. In my head, I was really good at Red Rover. I don't think I have the statistics to back those up. But Julie, Ginny had some great examples. Those are exactly the sorts of things we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew Red Rover and I knew Cat's Cradle, but I didn't know the throwing over the roof game. I grew up in southeastern Michigan as well, so we played a lot of Red Rover. I was not good at it. I've never been like a good runner. I could never break through their hands. So that one wasn't my favorite, but I do remember.
Jenny, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, talking about child lore, those games, those little tricks, the fortune-telling thing, so much more that kids just know and pass on to each other and maybe change and reinvent. And it shows up at different places and times. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Julie, the mention of MASH, most of our Central Time producers seem to remember that fondly. Now, when you were telling people you were writing about this, did you have a lot of those moments like, oh, yeah, I remember that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I was reading through this book by the British folklorist called The Lore of the Playground. And just every page was like bringing back memories like of these clapping games that I used to play and like the sort of various rules for different like hopscotch games or like tag variations. Some of the things I had, you know, remembered over the years, but it's sort of like the Proustian Madeleine, right? Like somebody mentions it and it just like comes flooding back all the memories.
I did a couple of the things you wrote about I hadn't heard of, but I was able to watch YouTube videos about them. I don't. Do you think that's going to help? I mentioned, you know, is technology going to kill these things? Is technology going to help amplify some of these things?
I think so, yeah. One of the researchers I spoke with, her specialty is kind of, you know, new media and play. And she mentioned that, yeah, sometimes kids will look up the rules for this or that clapping game online. So that is another way that it spreads. And it makes me wonder if the sort of regional variants will become a little bit more homogenized if kids are kind of learning in this more universal way online. It's not going to kill play, but it might like shift the way that kids learn these things.
Let's go back to our callers. John is with us in Osseo. John, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm actually a teacher in Osseo. And at the end of my class, if we're done with our schoolwork, I have a softball that I let the kids throw around the room, and they come up with their own rules. I've never introduced a game to them, but every day there's something new. Like, well, today let's throw it behind our back, or today you have to be on one foot when you throw it. If it bounces off your hand, you're out. It's just very interesting watching them create games as they go.
I love it, John. Thanks. And that speaks, Julie, to the inventiveness of children, I think.
Yeah, that's so fun. I mean, I don't know if the softball game is going to sweep the nation, although it might. But it's like what makes it really special is that like it's about the kids' agency and them coming up with what is interesting and fun and stimulating to them. And that's really the case for all of child lore, whether it's something that only exists in our college classroom or, you know, across the whole country.
Thanks for the call, John. Time for one more caller. Lori is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lori, hi.
Hi. I just tuned in on the radio, but I remember the game, the clapping game, Old Mary Mac, all dressed in black, black, black. Then you cross your arms and go down.
Right.
At your legs and clap your whoever you're doing it with.
Lori, thanks for that. Julie, I mentioned that as one example, but we haven't talked about those clapping and rhyming games, including, that's a big one, Mary Mac.
Yeah, I loved those. I remember Mary Mac, and there was like a bunch of other ones. And again, like not a visual medium, so hard to like explain. But yeah, they were really fun. And I think there's like been a ton of different regional variations on like how people do those rhymes too.
Lori, thanks for that call. And Julie, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was really fun.
That's Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees the family section. She was with us today to talk about her latest piece there. It's called Why Did We All Have the Same Childhood? Looking at how childhood traditions, child lore is shared. You can keep sharing yours, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, one you remember from your own childhood, one you've seen maybe in your own kid's life. You can also email us to let us know about those childhood memories. What games did you play with friends? Are there ones you still could sing today? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the debt ceiling is looming closer once again. Will Congress move it or risk a big economic hit around the world? We'll get the latest on the politics surrounding debt ceiling, a standoff between Republicans in the House and particular on the White and the White House on whether changes need to be made before that debt ceiling gets approved. And a philosopher makes the case that animals are beings, not things, and that we humans need to take responsibility for their well-being, especially in cases where we have caused them harm. On purpose, accidentally, you name it. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.